Hello, and welcome to the American Writers Museum Author Talks podcast, where we bring the power of the written word straight to your ears. May is Asian American and Pacific Islander Heritage Month, and we begin our celebration with that of R.O. Kwan, author of The Incendiaries. This conversation originally took place July 31st, 2019, and was recorded live in the museum. Kwan is also one of more than 30 writers featured in our special exhibit, My America, Immigrant and Refugee Writers Today, which you can explore online at my-america.org or in person when we reopen on May 14th. We hope you enjoy entering the mind of a writer.
We're here tonight to talk about a book that just a few people have heard of. Incendiaries is a story of love, violence, faith, and loss, and it was named a best book of the year by over 40 different publications. R.O. Kwan's writing has appeared in the New York Times, The Guardian, The Paris Review, and elsewhere. She's received fellowships and awards from the National Endowment for the Arts, McDowell, the Breadloaf Writers Conference, and the C1A Writers Conference. So welcome tonight, and thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me.
So did you have some words that you'd like to share with us about the book?
Yeah, so I'll talk a little bit about the book and I'll read from it briefly and then we could talk more.
Great.
So I am going to read from The Incendiaries. It's my first novel, and what I usually tell people it's about is that, I usually tell people that it's about a woman who gets involved with a group of fundamentalist Christians. The group turns out to be a cult, and they end up bombing abortion clinics, healthcare clinics, in the name of faith. And so I worked on this book for 10 years, pretty much every day for 10 years, which means that during those 10 years, I attended a lot of parties and dinner parties and most harrowing of all, Thanksgivings, at which people would ask what I do, and I would say, I write, I work on a novel, and they would ask what it's about. And so I would pretty much tell people what I just told you. And what I noticed over the years was that by far the most common follow-up question was, is your novel autobiographical? Which I never really knew what to do with, because there was only so many ways to interpret that, right? On the face of it, it kind of sounded as though people were asking, have you been involved in a violent extremist cult? Have you yourself blown up any buildings? And the short answer is no, I haven't blown up any buildings just yet. But there is a longer possible answer about what obsessions and losses led to this book. So I thought I'd touch briefly on that before reading from it. So I grew up so Christian that my entire life plan was to become a pastor or a missionary, right up until I lost my faith, which happened at 17. And It was devastating to lose God. It was devastating to lose that faith. There were multiple extra layers of loneliness and loss on top of it. So at the time I grew up in LA. At the time, pretty much everyone I knew, almost all my friends and family they ranged from like moderately Christian to like deeply Christian. That was the range. And so people thought that like it was a passing juvenile, just like a juvenile rebellion. That's pretty much sort of what my family still thinks it is. So this was, for me, it felt like this enormous loss. And I don't say this lightly at all. I'm very close to my family. But I remember very often thinking that I would so much rather have lost my parents than lost God, because the Christian God, in my understanding of the Christian God, promised we'd restore all that we'd lost. So I lived in a world until I was 17 in which I didn't think I would die. I didn't think anyone I loved would die. I didn't believe in the kind of final loss that I now take as a condition of being alive. So there was that. And then once I went out to college, which is about a year after this, I made a lot of new friends. I went to college on the East Coast, and almost all of my friends, they had pretty much no experience of religion. You know, they'd like maybe gone to Easter a few times with a parent, or they described themselves as being culturally Jewish, but not religiously. And so there was it was an entirely different world I was in. And almost all of my new friends, at some point I would tell them, I used to be really religious, like I was going to become a pastor. And their response across the board was one of just like puzzlement. And then just like, it was like, oh, that's really weird. And then they would say, good for you. You escaped. Like, welcome to the land of the living. You can drink enough sex with the rest of us. And I was like, that's true. And that's not how it feels to me. It doesn't feel like a jailbreak. It feels like what it was and is, again, this just like gigantic loss that in a lot of ways has divided my life into a before and afterward. And on top of everything else, I couldn't find my experience reflected in books at all. And that was an entirely different kind of loneliness because, as like a bookish introverted teenager, I was used to having trouble finding I was used to feeling sort of vaguely to intensely misunderstood. But I was used to finding companionship in books. I was used to finding fellowship in books. And for the first time in my life, I couldn't. So I wanted to write a book for that girl who felt alone in the world. I wanted to write a book for her to let her know that she was never as alone as she thought she was, and that she's not alone now. I also wanted to write a book that could communicate to some extent the enormity of the loss, but also how wonderful it was to believe. I wanted to talk about this, the full spectrum of faith as I had experienced it. And I think with writing this book, I ended up being very interested in writing a book that could perhaps serve as an imaginative bridge between different kinds of religious experience. And so, because I was learning that there are so many people who only ever experience one small slice of the faith spectrum. And that is very hard to make sense for a lot of people who exist on another part of the faith spectrum. So I want to write a book that could perhaps serve as an imaginative bridge for different people on different parts of that spectrum. That's pretty much what went into this book. Let's see, I'm going to read, I'll read just two short sections from the book. So the book is told in very short chapters, and I'll read from the point of view of Will Kendall, who also grew up very religious, and then lost his faith and then went off to college. And the woman he loves, Phoebe Lynn, who is the woman who ends up falling into the cult of the novel. And Will loves Phoebe and opposes much of what the cult represents. One, Will. They'd have gathered on a rooftop in Noxers to watch the explosion. Platt Hall, I think, 11 floors up. I know his ego, and he'd have picked the tallest point he could. So often, I've imagined how they felt, waiting. With 6 minutes left, the slant light of dusk reddened the high old spires of the college, the level gables of its surrounding town. They poured festive wine into big-bellied glasses. Handshaking, they laughed. She would sit apart from this reveling group, cross-legged on the roof's west ledge. 3 minutes to go, 2, 1. The Phipps building fell. Smoke plumed the breath of God. Silence followed, then the group's shouts of triumph. Wine glasses clashed together, flashing martial light. He sang the first bars of a Cheja song. Others soon joined in. Carolyn bells chimed, distant birds blowing white, strewn, like dandelion tufts, an outsized wish. It must have been then that John Leo came to her side. In his bare feet, he closed his arm around her shoulders. She flinched, looking up at him. I can imagine how he had tightened his hold, telling her she'd done well. Though before long, it would be time to act again, to do a little more. But this is where I start having trouble, Phoebe. Buildings fell. People died. You once told me I hadn't even tried to understand. So here I am, trying. 2, Phoebe. I hoped I'd be a piano genius, Phoebe told the group in the first Cheja confession she tried giving. But I didn't just wait, she said. I wanted to work for it. I spilled time into the piano as I'd have put cash in a bank. I saw full concert halls in the future, solo recitals, front page plaudits. I practiced Liszt while imagined spotlights gilded the living room. Recollection is half invention, but it feels as though I spent my entire childhood training to prove I was a significant pianist I believed I'd be. So I piled up trophies. It wasn't enough. The teacher flicked my hands with the rod each time I didn't hit the right note, but I didn't mind. My ambition outstripped his. Let my hands swell. I could use the extra span. Bright-knuckled, I tried again. The months ticked past, then years. I kept lists of rivals. I indexed others' exploits by age. Kiel, at 5, had given his first recital to the Danish king. Arai, 11, debuted at Carnegie Hall. Lou, 15. One night, my teacher called Libick's Etude No. 5 the most challenging piece a soloist might attempt. It's eluded the finest pianists, he said. I rushed to find the Etude score. I learned it alone, in secret. I memorized Libick's high trills. I flailed through wild ostinatos. Once, at the table, my mother asked what I was smiling about. Hejin, she said. I blinked, Libick vibrating in my head. I don't. She laughed. It's all right, she said. I ate while she peeled a white peach. The skin dropped in a single coil. She picked it up, holding it to the light. Such a rich hue, she said. It flushed pink, backlit. I nodded, then she put it down. I could tell she wished to talk, but I was lost in trills. I pushed a last peach slice in my mouth and I went back to the piano. Until then, nothing I played had evoked the Orphic singing I knew to be possible. It was an ideal I lacked the skill to bring to life. Each first place prize marked a point when I let the music down. With Libick, I failed less. His Etude asked so much of me that at times I forget I had an eye. I should have learned from this that playing had to be birthed in a place without ego, in which I didn't exist except as a living conduit, Libick's medium. But then, when I showed the teacher what I could do, he was astonished. I'd achieved more than he'd hoped, he said. He switched the piece in for the next competition, a city level open. I was driven to the recital hall. The sun fell on my hands as I practiced Libick again, fingers dancing across my legs. Spotlit, I listened to the traffic sing my name. The lax blue of LA, heat rippled, veiled the horizon. Like curtains, I thought, poised to rise. I'll stop there. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you. If there are questions that you would like to ask, please ask them, and then I will repeat them so that she can hear them. Who'd like to start? So the question was about your loss of faith. How did that happen?
Yeah, of course. I'm happy to talk about it. So, there's a line that Will, the first character I read from, there's a line that he says at some point in the novel, and that was very much taken from me, from my own experience of faith. He says that it's like what people say about bankruptcy, that it happened gradually and then all at once. And that's very much how it felt for me to lose that faith. There was just like a series of, there was a mounting pressure of questions that couldn't be not only addressed, because it's, I mean, questions don't necessarily have to be addressed, but that couldn't be accommodated within the belief system that I, as I understood it. And there was just one day when it was gone, it was there and then it was gone. There was no big, like, exciting event. It really was, it felt to me as though there were a lot of, like, you know, those zombie movies when there are like a lot of zombies and there's a door, but there's just like one door. And then there are more and more zombies and you can feel the pressure of them like shoving against the door. You're like, oh God, the zombies are going to break through the door. That's what it felt like, but like without the zombies. It felt like those were all the doubts. Those were all the questions that I couldn't resolve. I will say there was something about one of the contributing factors for me was I was always a big reader, as I'm sure a lot of people in this room are. And so I was used to, I spent so much time in the heads of people who did not believe what I believe, right? I spent so much time inhabiting the heads of people who didn't strictly believe what I believed. And it increasingly became impossible for me to believe that people who held different beliefs about the world and its order were going to go to hell because they didn't believe as I did. And so that was a big contributing factor.
A second question. I read that you worked on this book for something like 10 years and you hoped that the next book would go more quickly. Are you working on the next book and is it going more quickly?
So that, did you catch all of that?
Yeah, I did. No, that's a great question. Okay, so I am working on my next book. I've been working on it for 3 years. So it's already kind of a while. So I'm really holding out hope that it'll take like six years. Reasonable number to me. It's one digit. It's four fewer than the 10 years. But we'll see. Last year, I was on the road. Well, I've been on the road a lot for pretty much the last year, ever since the hardcover came out. And so I haven't, it's a lot harder for me, as it is for a lot of people. It's a lot harder for me to write unless I have sort of like a very strict schedule for myself. And so I spent pretty much all of 2018 barely writing fiction, which was so strange for me as someone who really did work on my fiction for every day for 10 years, pretty much. But I've recently started getting back into a rhythm, and I'm always happy to talk more about that kind of thing too. I recently started getting back into a rhythm where I'm writing every day, even sometimes if it's like yesterday the paperback came out and there was just like a lot of, there were a lot of things to do. And so I wrote, I think like two sentences, but that's still, you know, that's still being with the work. That's still hanging out with the work. And to me, that's really valuable. I work best if I can work every single day on my fiction, which I know not, that doesn't work for everybody, but for me, that's the best way to work.
Next question.
I guess I have a question. Your friend Jasmine Gilroy was here. And yeah. She mentioned, you know, that when she's writing, she will try to stay with it every day, like you're saying, even if she ends up throwing it all out, but she feels like it's not wasted because she's connecting with the characters. Do your characters evolve in that way, or you're always thinking about it?
What the last part of the question was, it, do your characters evolve?
Yeah, it was, do the characters evolve every day?
Ah, that's such an interesting question. I don't think I've ever been asked that before. They do. I don't know if they necessarily noticeably evolve every single day, but they do change dramatically. I very much believe with fiction writing, I don't feel as though I'm like the puppet master in control. I feel very much as though I'm more asking them to reveal themselves to me slowly over time. And it's a slow revelation, or maybe it's an excavation. Sometimes I feel as though I'm digging my way toward the book and toward the characters. So it feels it doesn't feel as though I'm making things happen. I'm asking the book to reveal itself to me over time, which sounds so like bizarrely mystical, but it's the only way that works for me. And I kind of really envy writers who feel as though they're in like perfect control, but it's just not, it's not what I do.
I have a question about like post-writing. What are some interpretations or reactions that have just kind of generally surprised you or you thought were interesting that you only got after you finished writing the book and started interacting with people who read it?
There were so many surprises. Let's see. One of the first big surprises was a lot of early readers were talking about how plotful the book is. And that was a really pleasant surprise because I was never thinking of writing a plotful book. I really have trouble thinking overtly about plot. Even the word, right? It's such like a plot. It's such a strange word. Anyway, there's this line in Lori Moore's story, How to Be a Writer, in which she says she's trying to be a writer. She's like in high school or college, and her teacher tells her, you know, like, you're an interesting writer, but you are desperately bad at plot. And then she goes back to her desk and then she mutters to herself, plots are for dead people. And I think about that a lot. And I love that because, again, I have really a trouble thinking overtly about plots. And that was a really pleasant surprise. I hear so much from, and I love hearing from readers in general, but it's meant so much to me to hear from people who also have complicated relationships with faith. People who've lost their faiths or in the process of losing it or questioning all their what they believe. I think especially because a lot of people say, you know, a lot of people who want to talk about this, they say, you know, I really felt alone with this. And that brings me back to, again, to that 17-year-old girl I was who felt just like desperately alone. And it means the world to me that I can not only provide, but also find this kind of fellowship through this book. And so that's been really lovely. A third surprise has been, it's like before the book came out, I was a little talking with friends and talking about what the book is doing. I was actually kind of worried that the book would end up being like banned by an extreme Christian group in some way. Although, and then a friend was like, wouldn't a ban be good for your book sales? Like, I don't think it's that would be such a bad thing. And I was like, oh, yeah, fair point. But in fact, like most, at least so far, very religious people who've read the book, they haven't felt at all, they've said that they really appreciate the ways in which the book does not laugh at faith. It doesn't sneer at faith. It doesn't sneer at religious people. It doesn't treat religion or religious people like a punchline in any way. And I think that that's relatively not all that easy to find in fiction like this. In fiction that's not overtly written for believers. And that's been really meaningful too. I've loved having conversations with people who are very religious.
I wanted to ask you about Will's Rape of Phoebe. I didn't see that coming. So I was wondering what your experience as a writer was like, sort of arriving at that decision.
Yeah, no, I'm very happy to talk about it. Maybe for any future questions that have to do with like major plot points, maybe they could be more generally addressed, because I know some people, if there are people who haven't read the book, I know people get like very unhappy about spoilers. It's actually something
spoiler warning.
Yeah, and it's something that like I personally don't like care about at all. I love spoilers. I find plot to be like so stressful that when I was watching Friday Night Lights, I got so stressed out that I would read the Wikipedia entries ahead of time for the entire season. So I could stop being so worried about like, is that person going to get to go to college? Like, are they going to get that fellowship? And I couldn't be concerned. Anyway, okay. So back to my book. Decision is not how I feel when I write. Like, again, I truly don't feel as though I'm making decisions. I don't feel as though I'm like putting my characters through any kind of actions. And so that's a much more active verb. What happened was that, so I came to the scene in which, this pivotal scene in which Will turns violent. And And as I started realizing what was possibly going to happen, I was like genuinely, as one would be, I think, this was a character I'd been hanging out with for years and years and years. I was appalled, and I was just like, seriously, dude, this is who you turned out to be? Seriously? And I wrote like several drafts in which that didn't happen, in which he doesn't attack anyone. But it just kept ringing really false to me. Like, I kept feeling really bad and wrong. And I didn't really know why that was. And so I went back. Often when I'm confused in my writing, I often find that like going back and looking at the text can help provide a guidepost. And I read everything I had up until then. And I realized there were so many ways in which, and I hadn't really even consciously thought about it, but there's so many ways in which Will privileges his own desires. He privileges his own wants over those of others. There are real problems with the ways in which he looks at women, the ways in which he engages with women and Phoebe as full human beings. And I realized that this is who he was. This was who he'd been all along. I hadn't really known it, and I hadn't really picked up on it. So I wrote the scene in that it felt like the most truthful version of what he would do in that moment.
Okay, so the question was about Will's race, whether or not he is white, and if so, you know, the decision not to detail his race or his, you know, or to describe him that way, whereas describing Phoebe in great detail.
Like I knew she was Korean American.
Like the person who's asking the question knew she was Korean American, but didn't know if Will was white.
Yeah, that's a great question. That's something I thought about a lot, and something I think about a lot when I read too. He is, to my mind, he was and is white. I really wanted to, because there are ways in which, for those of you who haven't read it, there are ways in which there are three points of view, but the book plays, has like a slip sliding point of view, so that at least as I imagined it, the book is fundamentally really told 100% by Will. And he's sort of imagining his way into the other characters' points of view. And so in a lot of ways, I felt I not only had to, but I really wanted to inhabit his point of view. And his point of view is as someone who's white, he doesn't think very much about it. He doesn't think very much about his own race as being a race, which is something, of course, that like a lot of white people in America don't really do. They don't think of whiteness as a race. They think of it as a default. And the rest of us have races that, like, I don't know, that are that are somehow more evident. So in inhabiting Will, that was something that I very much want. I didn't want to lie by making this more conscious of race as it applied to Will than he would be. That would be untruthful to the fiction, to his point of view and to his head. That said, how do I say this? The first 2 years that I was writing this book, it was told entirely from Phoebe's point of view. And then for a variety of reasons that had to do with the sort of expansiveness that the book that I got once I could step sort of outside of Phoebe's point of view, and had someone telling the story who's not Phoebe, who's not at the center of the action, that's just brought a lot of air into the book in a way that it didn't when Phoebe was telling it. So, which is a roundabout way of saying that I did not set out to write a book told entirely from the point of view of a white man. And my next book, my new novel that I've been working on for 3 years, it is, the two main characters are women and both are Korean. And I'm trying so hard to, because of the ways in which point of view tends to be something I love to play with, I'm trying so hard to just like keep like all men out of it. Like, I'm just like, men, be quiet. Like, I really need this book to be told from the point of view of Korean American women. Like, maybe one Korean American woman, maybe both Korean American women, but like, for God's sake, I'm going to hang out with a woman this time.
So the question was where you are now with your faith, and do you feel that that's a place of rest, or are you still in the midst of a journey with it? And then also, how do you feel towards people who identify as having very deep faith?
That's such a great question. No one's really asked that before. That's so interesting. Okay. I would say, so I'm allergic to certainty. I'm allergic to overriding belief systems, so much so that, like, you know how an icebreaker or like just as like a I'm trying to get to know you kind of way, people ask what your astrological sign is. And like very often, especially if it's someone I don't know otherwise, like I'll just launch into like an uncomfortable spiel about like, I'll say, you know, like I don't really like, I have some history with organized religion and like, I don't really like even thinking about my astrological sign. Like I super support that. Like it works for other people, but it's just not for me. Like it's not. And like people are just like, dude, I was trying to be fun. Like you're like, really and I realize that this is, I need to find a better way to address this, but I shy away from that kind of, from believing anything that anyone else is telling me to believe that's not based in like provable scientific fact. That said, I'm so much on the side of being allergic to certainty that I don't want to be certain that this is where I'm always going to be, you know? I'm allergic to even that certainty. And so who knows what I'm going to continue to believe. I very much doubt that I would go back to Christianity. It feels very much like a, you know, it feels like I left the garden. I left the garden. I loved being there. I loved being Christian, and it's gone for me. As for how I feel about people who are very religious, by and large, I feel great envy. I was so happy when I was really religious. I walked around feeling like bathed in light, you know, like I was walking around in a state of grace. I was walking around I felt as though I was in communication with the ecstatic and with the divine in a way that is not generally readily available in daily life. And that's gone too. And I miss that. I miss that kind of that feeling of being held by the world. I miss that greatly. And yeah, so I really envy a lot of very religious people. And insofar as their beliefs don't try to cancel out mine and my rights and the rights of women and the rights of people of color and the rights of, like, insofar as those beliefs don't try to are harmful, I personally, like, I'm just like, great, good for you. It's only when those beliefs start causing problems with the rights of other people that then I start having problems. But I don't think that's very rare.
I think I know the answer to this. My question is, do you write with an outline? It sounds like maybe you don't. Maybe you start with characters and a scenario and see where it leads you. But let me know your answer to that.
Yeah, of course. Your hunch is correct. I don't really write with an outline. At some point with the first novel, I think at like the 3-year mark, I wrote like a sad, quick 1-page outline just so I could see what it looked like visually, just structurally, what it all looked like. And then I think I like maybe opened the document 2 or 3 more times over the rest of the time I worked on the novel. And I never really looked at it again. And with this new novel, again, and 3 years into it, and I've never written an outline, maybe I will after this draft, but again, it'll be really fast. Like, it'll be like a 1-page outline. And for me, at least, I would be so bored if I knew ahead of time everything that was going to happen, or even the gist of what was going to happen. And I want my characters to surprise me. I want them to become who they are without my predetermining it in a lot of ways. And so an outline would be counterproductive for me. That said, I know outlines like help a lot of writers, and a lot of writers swear by them. I mean, The Ascendaries is a very short book. And the next book I'm going to write is also a very short book. So being this short, I'm almost able to like hold it in my head, you know? It's not as though like characters get away from me. I'm not like, who is that guy? Because there aren't that many people in the book over the course of the book. If I were writing like one of those like gigantic 900-page books with like multi-generation spanning countries, I'm pretty sure I would need an outline because I would get very confused.
So did the book ever have another title, and how did you choose The Incendiaries?
Yeah, so the book originally, it sold as Heroics was the working title. And I was really, I was like okay with the title, but I, for me, that was a placeholder title because everything I had heard from all my friends who had sold books was nobody ever lets you keep your title. They all want you to change it anyway. So I was like, okay, I'm not even going to get attached to a title. I'm just going to slap on a sort of placeholder title and that'll be fine. And that was what it was for years. And bizarrely, my editor at Riverhead, the publisher, she was like, I love the title. We're keeping the title. So I was like, what? Really? I felt a little weird about that because at least for me, the word heroics has ironic undertones that I didn't necessarily think fit the book. I mean, it does, but it doesn't really, the book's not like a terribly ironic book in that way. And so I was just like, okay, maybe this is okay. And I was trying to be okay with it. And then like at the 11th hour, when the book was about to be printed in galleys, galleys being the early copies that people send out to early readers and reviewers, my editor like emailed me and she was just like, marketing hates the title. We need a new title. And I was like, what? And then she said, and she was saying, well, you know, it's we're worried everyone will think it's about superheroes, like that's about Batman. I was like, okay, I guess that's not good. And somehow this led me to, I pushed really hard for like a week for the title Superhuman. And I was like, well, you know, Superhuman, it has to do with like the supernatural for first of all. And then I was like, but also, you know, like I like said this in an email. I can't believe I said this in an email. I was like, but I also mean superhuman in like the Nietzschean sense, which I think people will totally get. And then, and my poor editor was just like, so that still sounds like superhero. That's still, we're still worried everyone's going to think it's about Batman. This is not going to work. And then we were tossing back a lot of titles back and forth. And then the incendiaries just like came to me. And I think there was something about, I really like how the word has multiple valences, how it can be interpreted in multiple ways. So of course incendiaries are like, can also be explosions. But it can also have to do with incendiary speech with inciting others toward violence. It also, something I very much had on my mind was when I was Christian, we used to talk a lot about being on fire for God. That's a pretty common phrase that Christians will use, at least some Christians. And I love that sense of like that burning for God, that burning for faith, that burning for love. I love the sense of having that sort of permeate the novel a little more with the title.
Are there any other questions? If not, there's one that I'd like to ask you, and that is, you know, who are some writers that you're reading right now that you love or that you are inspired by?
Oh my gosh, I love that question. And I always freeze up when it gets asked. It's like I should have them ready because otherwise, often when I'm hit with that question, I'm like, I don't know. Do I even read? Let's see. There is a book coming out in the spring by C. Pam Zhang called How Much of These Hills is Gold? And it's about Chinese Americans during the gold rush. And it's just, it's an astonishing book. I got to read an early copy. It's astonishing. And it really tells a story that like, at least I had never read like a full book about the experience, about an experience of Chinese American people during the gold rush. And so of course being where it's set and with Chinese American people at the center, it grapples with race in really powerful ways. It grapples with belonging in really powerful ways. They're like extended, really weird, creepy, bizarrely beautiful descriptions of a corpse. It's like one of the best descriptions of a corpse I've ever read. So that's one. But that is not helpful to you all because the book is not out. So another book I think The Old Drift by Naomi Serpell, which came out a few months ago, I'm in the middle of it. It's really wonderful. This is one of those like 900 page books that I'm talking about. It's a huge book. Goes all over the place. It's amazing.
Well, thank you so much for being here with us.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the AWM Author Talks podcast. Tune in next week to hear June Herr discuss her debut novel, The Silence of Bones. Now go, be inspired, and find the mind of a writer in yourself.